Beyond the locker room was a round room about 6 feet in diameter, just big enough for three people to stand, a bit crowded, wearing those suits. Corwin made doubly sure her helmet was locked, locked his own and had her check it, and then closed the heavy, curved door into this little room behind him and dogged it securely. There were two controls on the floor where he stood. He towed one of them, and with a loud hiss, the little round room evacuated. One of the status displays in Utrina's helmet informed her that she was now in hard vacuum. She found herself surprisingly unworried by this. Corwin grinned, then towed the other control. Above their heads, the ceiling irised open, revealing a disk of inky night speckled with stars. A moment later, the floor beneath them rose, delivering them through that disk and onto the upper hull of the one-hit wonder. Utrina gasped. Since coming to this world, she'd seen wonders, most notably the glittering golden city of New Avalon, home to buildings so tall that her Sephirian imagination had had to stretch to accommodate them. But this topped everything else. Stretching out in front of the one-hit wonder's gleaming black delta hull was the silvery-gray expanse of the lunar surface, and hanging in the sky above them was the planet Earth. Corwin smiled and led her to the point at the front of the ship, and then, without ceremony, jumped off. She gasped again, this time for a different reason. It was quite a long way down from the top of the freighter, and she felt he would surely break his legs. Instead, he sailed leisurely down like a falling soap bubble, alighting below with a puff of dust. "The ship's gravity ends at the edge of the hull," his voice crackled in her ears. "Come on down, it's fun." And indeed it was. Utrina had always been good at jumping. Every duel she'd fought was punctuated by at least one spring that would have done a hunting cat proud. Now, as she leaped off the point of the one-hit wonder's prow toward the surface of the moon, she felt positively superhuman. And when she landed in the dust near Corwin, she was laughing, her troubles cast off with the gravity of the Earth. "You wanted someplace quiet and private?" said Corwin. "Here you go. All the settlements on the moon are on the side you can't see from Earth. International agreement back in the 2000s. So that the view of the moon from groundside will never be marred by domes or gardens. I'm willing to bet you and I are the only people on this whole hemisphere right now." He grinned. "You want more privacy than that, I'll have to leave you here by yourself." "That won't be necessary," she assured him, and then took another experimental leap. The balance took a little getting used to, but the suit, lightweight and comfortable even in standard gravity, was no hindrance at all in the 1/6 G of the lunar surface. They bounded together in silence across the gray desert for a few minutes, until the one-hit wonder was a gleaming black dot on the unusually close horizon behind them. Electronic trackers built into their suits ensured that they could easily find their way back to it. Or, for that matter, Corwin could call it to them with a remote rig unit built into his suit's Vambrace computer. There, they sat down together on the regolith, their backs to a boulder, and looked up at the beautiful blue-white disk of the Earth. "My God, it's beautiful," said Utrina. Corwin grinned again and pressed a button on his arm unit. He reached across and pressed the same one on Utrina's, then leaned against her so that their helmets clunked gently together. "How's this for privacy?" he asked, and his voice didn't come over the radio. It vibrated, a little hollow but clear, through the material of the helmets themselves. She chuckled, then patted his gloved hand with her own. "Thank you," she said. "This was exactly what I needed." "It's what I'm here for," he replied. "After what you told me tonight, I wanted to show you something..." He paused as if searching for words. "Something he could never show you." Utrina turned her head, giving him a searching look through the viewplates of their helmets, and he gestured toward the Earth. "As you can see from this vantage point," he said didactically, "the world is round." She looked, nodded, then gave him a yes and look. Therefore, Corwin went on with a tentative grin, it has no end. It took the full meaning of that statement a second to sink in. Then Utrina chuckled and squeezed his hand, thanking him silently with her eyes. They settled back against the boulder and looked up at the endless world in comfortable silence. I wish Himemia could see this, Utrina said after a while. We'll bring her here and show her, Corwin promised. I'll bring a portadome. You can spend the night. Utrina chuckled. Camping on the moon. Sure, people do it all the time. Dad's got a castle on Titan, Corwin told her. The moon of Saturn? The same. Wow. Is it on the side you can see Saturn from? Sure is. That must be something. Most beautiful thing I've ever seen, Corwin agreed. This is a close second, though. The debates over whether or not to terraform the moon raged for decades after first contact, he explained. I'm glad they didn't do it. One of the first Earthmen to come here described the regolith as magnificent desolation, said the isolation was unlike anything he'd ever felt. And some people wanted to destroy it, make it just like every place else, said Utrina. Yep, but they didn't win. He picked up a small rock and hurled it an impossible distance with a negligent flip of his arm. On the moons of Mars, it's possible to throw things hard enough that they never come down. Hell, on Phobos, if you get a good enough run, you can jump right off the end and go into your own orbit of Mars. To the Martians, it's a kind of sport. What a universe. On the other hand, Corwin went on thoughtfully, there's something to be said for terraforming. Titan was a toxic swamp. Now it's a beautiful forest planet with a ringed gas giant hanging in half the sky. It rains a lot on the northern continent, but it's so pretty. When I was 6, Mom took me sailing on the Tsiolkovsky Sea. Saturn, half sunk in the glassy calm, reflected back on itself, with our catamaran sailing through the rings. He sighed. There are so many beautiful things, so many wonders in this life. Saturn, the Denorius Belt, Black Hole X-21, the Aurora Asgardis, the ice castles of Alfheim. You've seen a lot, Utrina observed, for a guy your age. I have, he acknowledged. My parents and Kay, they're all big fans of experience over hearsay. They've always encouraged me to go and see things for myself. Someday I hope to share all that with you. You and Anthy, too, if she's interested. I hope she likes me. He chuckled awkwardly. Seems silly, but I hardly know what to call her. I like the way you call her by her last name, and has a sort of Victorian adventuring gentleman's way about it, my dear Watson. That's not my style, though. I just feel weird. But calling her by her first name when we've never met seems presumptuous, and using her title is so impersonal. Utrina laughed. I think you're thinking about it too hard. When you meet her, you'll know what to say. She squeezed his hand. And she will like you, she added in a softer, more serious tone. I can't see how she could not. You'll like her, too. She's quieter than me, but once you get to know her, she's... Utrina groped for words to describe something that lived so vividly in her heart and memory that she generally needed none to call it to mind, then gave up and said, Well, you'll see. Your Aunt Belle kind of reminds me of her a little. So does Kate. Said Corwin. Well, when you find her, if she wants to, we'll explore the galaxy, see all the beautiful things. Sounds good to me, said Utrina. They lay back against the boulder and watched the Earth turn slowly above them. Corwin? Asked Utrina presently. Is it safe to sleep in these things? Sure, he replied. They're extended duty suits for vacuum construction and the like. They're built to be slept in. They've got 24 hours of air, and the environmental monitor systems will wake us if anything comes up that needs attention. Good. Utrina stretched and yawned, then put her helmet back against his. I could get used to this gravity. Lunar colonists swear by it. Of course, after a few months, if you let your physical training slip, you can't go back into a standard environment without a lot of discomfort. Well, just for tonight, then, she said. But it is nice. Yep. Another pause. Corwin? Yeah? Thanks. Again. You're welcome. Always. Kate and Jury were crossing the faculty parking lot in front of Sanford Riley Hall, Jury ruminating about what an unexpected and interesting turn the evening had taken, Kate wondering idly if it would be inappropriate to try holding Jury's hand, when they noticed what appeared to be a bit of a scuffle next to one of the cars. No, damn it! Didn't you hear me? Jury glanced at Caitlin, whose eyes had narrowed behind her glasses. Her face, smiling and calm all night, had gone hard and cold. There was another voice, lower and deeper. They couldn't make out what it said, and then the other voice returned. I don't care what your father told you. Your idea of a merger agreement is... Ouch! Stop it! Let go! Fabric tore. Caitlin was gone. Jury blinked, then shook herself out of her surprise and ran toward the sounds, her hand steadying her sword for the draw. She wondered where Kate had disappeared to. Suddenly there was a sharp, painful-sounding whack from the struggling silhouettes ahead, and one of them separated from the other, reeling backward. What the fuck? Said the deeper voice in a blurry, thick tone. Whack! The shape reeled again as if struck, but there was nothing there. A third, meteor-sounding impact, and the man's shape folded in the middle and collapsed to its knees. A fourth, and it pitched over backward, sprawling on the asphalt. A long, thin shadow cast by the overhead parking lot lights glided across the gray space between two cars, falling across the sprawled shape. And suddenly, there was Caitlin, standing over the fallen form which Jury now was close enough to recognize as the young man Liza Broadbank's father had sent to accompany her to the formal. His face was ashen gray in the wan light of the parking lot lamps. A black smear of blood ran from one corner of his mouth across his cheek. A scraping sound, and Caitlin's blade was unsheathed, its tip dimpling the skin of his Adam's apple. Get up! She hissed to him, in a low, wrath-filled tone that Jury had never imagined could come from Kate's sweet voice. Go back where you came from. Never show yourself to me again. The young man crab-walked away from the leveled sword, his eyes wide with terror. Without a word, he scrambled to his feet and ran, vanishing around the corner of Riley Hall. The sound of his panic footfalls echoed, fading off down Institute Road and blending away into the night sounds of Worcester. Kate whirled her Zatoichi and sheathed it katana fashion before turning to the huddled form of the girl her former prey had been assaulting. Are you all... she began, but then recoiled as the erstwhile victim uncoiled and lashed out with a slap across her face that resounded as much as had the crack of the Zatoichi's sheathed blade against the attacker's skull. Leave me alone! For God's sake! Of all the people in this world, in this universe, why did you have to come along? The voice, strident with rage and blurred with obvious drunkenness, belonged to Elizabeth Broadbank. That's a fine attitude to take, said Jury coldly. Caitlin just saved you from... save it, said Kate shortly. I didn't expect gratitude. Well, good for you, because you won't get it, railed Liza. Don't think for a minute that this means I owe you or anything. I don't, said Kate flatly. Come on, jury. Let's go. She turned and walked away. Don't you walk away from me, Caitlin Hutchins, Liza cried. Damn you! What gives you the right to rescue me? What gives you the right? Caitlin ignored her, and a few minutes later she had vanished into the front door of Daniel's Hall. Liza, a few steps behind, turned to give one cool look back at Liza, then turned and followed her in. Liza burned with hatred. Of all the people to see her in such a moment of shame, too much to drink, fighting off the odious pawing of that idiot Sean Creighton, a situation she should never have allowed herself to get into in the first place, why, in the names of all the Centauri gods, had Caitlin been the one to happen upon her? To be saved by her, under the eyes of that cursed redhead. She screamed in frustration and smashed a fist into the window of the car next to her. Jury felt slightly worried as she and Kate crossed the deserted wedge and climbed the stairs to the fourth floor of Morgan Hall. Kate's face was still rigid with fury, and despite the extremely rude way she'd been treated by Liza, Jury didn't think that was the reason. Naturally, she would be offended by what she had broken up. Who wouldn't be? But there was a rage boiling underneath Caitlin's too composed exterior that Jury had never seen, never sensed the potential for. And truth be told, it actually frightened her a little. The way she'd dealt with Liza's attacker, swift, efficient, painful, vicious. The fearful intensity in her face and eyes now, it worried her considerably. Jury was no stranger to rage. It had overtaken her several times in the past, but hers never lasted, never lingered and seethed the way this did. As they arrived on the fourth floor, she couldn't really think of any way to put all that into words, so she settled for putting her hand on Kate's shoulder and asking quietly, "Are you all right?" Kate turned to her, and Jury was startled to see her brown eyes full of unshed tears. "No," Kate replied flatly. "Would..." Jury paused, feeling unwontedly awkward. She wasn't very good at this kind of thing. Lack of practice, lack of natural inclination, both conspired to hamper her efforts. "Would you like to talk about it?" "Yes," said Kate, and she let them into Morgan 412. Martine Leclerc put the last of her few belongings into the plastic travel case, thankful to be leaving this school and this fruitless assignment. She would be more thankful still when she no longer had to share a room with the man standing next to the door. He wasn't much to look at, really. A tall, broad-shouldered man with short-cropped blonde hair over an unremarkable face with a rather weak chin. Easily missed in a crowd, except for two things. For one, he was dressed in the intimidating black uniform of a psycop, badge, gloves, and all. For another, he possessed the coldest, deadest gray eyes Martine Leclerc had ever had the misfortune to see. A reptile's eyes, like two little chips of slate. They didn't look at anything so much as through it, into its darkest secrets. And right now, they were looking at Martine Leclerc. "You're certain you can't give us anything more to go on?" he said, in a calm, smooth voice that was as dead inside as his eyes. "I'm quite certain, Director Tremaine," Miss Leclerc replied, struggling to keep her voice even. Of course, Tremaine was a psycop, rating P-12, with the training to back it up. Her fear was as obvious to him as the gold Psycor badge on his chest was to her. Still, she felt a small sense of victory at being able to maintain an illusion that would have fooled a normal, had anyone been present. As you requested, I interviewed every student and faculty member at this institution, Miss Leclerc went on. As you ordered, she went on archly, I performed an illegal surface scan on each and every one of them, in conjunction with the standard white tiger interrogation method. Quick, don't think about a white tiger. Clever, isn't it? And you got nothing. Oh, I got quite a bit, replied Miss Leclerc, but none of it was of any help in identifying a potential blip in the student population. Frankly, Director Tremaine, I think this whole thing was a wild goose chase. Your tip was false. It was quite credible, said Tremaine mildly. Anonymous tips are seldom credible, said Miss Leclerc primly, especially since they couldn't be bothered to give a name. The door to the office opened, nearly hitting the psychop, and Miss Leclerc gasped to see who had shoved it open. Elizabeth Broadbank stood in the doorway, her yellow ball gown rumpled, the bodice partly torn away, her hair disheveled, the knuckles of her left hand bloody, her eyes bloodshot, and her face haggard with pain and anger. The unmistakable scent of vodka reached both telepaths' noses, as the waves of disorganized rage and shame rolled across their mental receptors. "I know who you're looking for," she said. Roger Tremaine, Regional Director for Psionic Enforcement Operations, North America Sector 3, smiled a cold, dead smile and glided smoothly across the room to place his gloved hands on Liza's shoulders. "Talk to me," he said softly. A Reproductions Unlimited presented Undocumented Features Future Imperfect, Symphony of the Sword, Fifth Movement, Roses in Springtime. The symphony will return with Hunted Rose.